the savior or world leader, whichever you prefer, will have very special education and training, and in the year 2005, when he is 20 years of age, he will do much to confound godless people who do not believe in gods, saviors, etc., etc. Again, there will be a case of transmigration. If those of you who know the Bible well will study it with an open mind, you will find that the body of Jesus was taken over by the Spirit of God, the Christ. In much the same way, the body of the New World leader will be taken over by a very high personage indeed, and during the few years after that there will be remarkable events, and the world will be led along those essential steps which will prepare it for the start of a new cycle. For some 2,000 years the world will make progress by following the precepts of the church to be founded by the new leader, but at the end of that 2,000 years yet another leader shall arise, the 12th of the cycle, completing the destiny of the zodiac traversal. Conditions shall improve, and so, gently. 23. The due course of time, people shall be led into a new age where they have different abilities from those now existing. There shall be clairvoyance and telepathy as there was before the so-called, miscalled, Tower of Babel, in which through abuse of special powers mankind lost their telepathic abilities for the time being. The whole story is given in the Bible, but it is in the form of a story. Man was able to communicate with fellow man and with the animals, too, but through treachery to the animal world mankind was deprived of telepathic communication, and so there was the utter confusion of people trying to converse in what were local dialects, and which in time became the languages of the world. This world can now be likened to a train. Train has been going through various stages of scenery. It has been traversing pleasant sunlit lands which can correspond to stage 1, lands in which there was beautiful scenery and amiable fellow passengers. But then we come to stage 2, when the passengers all changed, and this new lot were not so friendly, nor was the journey so pleasant because there was an uneven track with many clattering switch points, and the journey continued through depressingly gloomy terrain where the smoke of the Reuss factories belched vile chemicals into the atmosphere. Here the passengers were quarreling and almost coming to blows, but worse was to come. At the third stage the passengers changed again and a lot of bandits got aboard, bandits who tried to rob other passengers. There was much stabbing, much sadistic action. The train, too, rocked along the edge of narrow gorges where landslides made travel precarious. Was discordant noise and the continual quarreling of the unhappy passengers. Again the train stopped and took on fresh passengers. This time conditions were even worse. The new passengers were almost wrecking their train, damaging the fittings, torturing, swindling, and engaging in all those activities which the decent person finds abominable. And went through increasingly difficult land, with badly laid rails, with many detours and obstructions. There came a long and gloomy tunnel. The train plunged in and there appeared to be no lights anywhere in the train. The passengers were in darkness, like the people of the world itself, leaderless. The gloom became gloomier, and the atmosphere more dismal, until the train was pitching and tossing in absolute darkness, with the darkness that comes in a passage through the heart of a mountain. Our train is now in its darkest phase. It cannot get darker, therefore it must get lighter. As the train goes rocketing along it will get lighter and lighter, and eventually, as a new age approaches, the train will burst forth from the mountainside, and below the passengers will see a fair and pleasant land with sparkling waters, herds of cattle grazing peacefully. The sun will be shining, and as the train goes on, ever-changing passengers, they will one find that conditions become better and better. Where men respect the rights of others, where there is no longer terrorism, sadism, and torture. But much has to be done at the present time because before the golden age shall come there will be much more hardship and suffering on this world. Prediction is dealt with in another chapter of this book, but possibly it would not be amiss to say something here. Old art of astrology. Many sad events are going to take place on this earth. Round about the year 1981 there will be a very substantial and unexpected increase in the world's heat, with a reduction in rainfall and a drying up of crops, and fruit and other plants will wither up before they can be gathered. This great heatwave could easily be the result of an atom bomb dropped by the Chinese. The Chinese are making haste to develop a super bomb, and the present-day Chinese are like mad dogs, without thought for the rest of the world, because the rest of the world keeps them in virtual seclusion and they do not know what is happening elsewhere, and it is a sad fact that one always fears the person one does not know. The Chinese, in their xenophobic state of mind, are ready to lash out at that which they do not understand. One also has to bear in mind that it was bad enough when only the United States had the atom bomb, but now the Russians, the French, the Chinese, and perhaps others have this device. Conditions have reached a most precarious pass. Much preliminary work has to be done before the advent of the new leader. When, and how? Other people have to be excluded from getting much knowledge. To the disciples who are now born and who are still but children, there are those much older people with special knowledge who have to write about such things so that 5. The knowledge will be disseminated, and who will thus pave the way? These older people will not, of course, be upon the earth at the time of the new coming, but like those who are to come after, these forerunners will have done their task by taking upon themselves the hatred and the suspicions which always come to the innovator. They do not understand, and so if it is said that a person has changed bodies with another, then he is automatically the subject of much persecution. But it is necessary that there be incidents of changing bodies to bring it into the public consciousness, so that when the new leader comes, people will be able to accept the truth of transmigration of souls and the changing of bodies. Those who are undergoing the scorn and ridicule and active persecution of an ill-informed press at present, they will know in the fullness of time that their suffering and misery has been justified. Often people will say, "Oh, but if these people have such great powers, why do they live in poverty? If they were truly what they say they are, they would have all the money they wanted." This is utterly ridiculous, because a person who comes to this earth under different conditions is something like a splinter in the body of the world, and if you have a splinter in your thumb, you agitate and fidget and you mess about until eventually you get that splinter dislodged, and you spare no liking for that splinter. In the same way, people who come to this world and change bodies and try to prepare a way for another, they too are like a splinter. The world finds them strange. People may be uncomfortable in the presence of such a being. Rather than blame their own lack of development, they always try to put the blame on the other person. "Oh, he is queer. He makes me have such an uncanny feeling when he touches me." So, the old world goes rolling along full of trouble. But the darkest hour is before the dawn, and when things are at their blackest, there is the happy thought that any change can be for the better, and this world and the peoples of this world, after their blackest hour, will go on and on into the light, when mankind shall be tolerant of mankind, and when the little people of the animal world shall be understood instead of misunderstood, feared, and tormented as they are at present. Beginning with the year 2000, the world shall have pleasures, and a golden age shall dawn. 26. Chapter 2. Mansions. Alone he was, alone in the old rambling house in the heart of the moor. Off at the end of the long, cultivated garden, a noisy brook went tumbling over the rocks and hissing across the stony stretches. On a warm day he was wont to stand by that babbling brook, or perch on one of the large rocks overhanging the tumultuous torrent. Along there was the little wooden bridge with a shaky handrail by which he crossed on his way to the small hamlet for his mail and shopping. It had been pleasant here. He and his wife, together they had tried to make a home, tried to keep body and soul together while he painted and waited for recognition. But, as usual, the press had not understood, nor tried to understand, his art, and so the critics had damned his work with faint praise. Recognition was as far off as ever, and now he was alone in the old, old house, his mind and mood in a turmoil matched by the gale outside. Across the moorland heather the gale screeched in unbridled fury, lashing the yellow gorse, making it bow to the mighty wind. Distance he was a boiling white mass of foam, with mighty waves breaking in thunder on the great granite shore, dragging back the pebbles with a nerve-jarring scream. A lone gull soared backwards overhead, blowing helplessly inland, powerless in the grip of the storm. Old house shook and shuddered to the ceaseless pounding of the elements. Flecks of cloud, driven low, whipped by the windows like ghosts seeking entry. A sudden metallic clatter and rumble, and a sheet of corrugated metal went spinning across the garden, to strike the bridge and shear through the old timbers. For a time the broken ends vibrated like an overtaxed violin string. Then, one after the other, They shuddered and tumbled into the brook. Inside the house, oblivious of the turmoil, the man paced back and forth, seeing again and again, the moment when he had returned from the hamlet and found his wife gone. He reading the bitter note in which she told him that he was a failure, and she was going elsewhere, grimly, as a sudden thought struck him, he strode to the battered old desk and wrenched open the center drawer, rooting in the back. He dragged out the cigar box in which he kept the rent and living money. Even before he opened it he knew that it was empty. The money, his only money, gone. Groping his way to a chair he sat down and buried his head in his hands. "Before," he whispered, "before, this has happened to me before." Lifting his head he stared unseeingly through the window against which torrential rain was beating in an unceasing stream, forcing its way through a loose-fitting window and collecting in a spreading pool on the carpet. "I've lived through all this before. Have I gone insane? Could I have known about this?" Against the ancient stone hedge the little moorland ponies huddled head to wind in abject misery, trying to get even slight shelter for stinging eyes. Away in the hall the telephone rang and rang, jarring him from his lethargy, which ceased its clanging even as he stretched out his hand to lift it. Amid to the uncaring walls, "Tea has all happened before." The professor plodded wearily across the quadrangle on his way to the lecture hall. The years had been hard ones indeed. Born in very humble circumstances he had been the bright boy who had slaved and earned that he could put himself through college. Been almost a lifetime of clawing his way up against the opposition of those who resented his humble origin. Now in the evening of his life the weight of time was showing in his white hair, lined face, and feeble step. He stumbled slowly along, oblivious of the greetings of undergraduates. He pondered on many obscure facets of his specialty. Ancient history. Completely the model of the absent-minded professor, he fumbled for the doorknob of a door already open, and not finding it, turned away, muttering, "Dear, dear, most strange, most strange, there used to be a door here. Be in the wrong building." An understanding student, one who had profited from the old man's brilliant lectures, took his arm and gently turned him round. "Sir," he said, "have opened the door for you. In here." Thankfully the professor turned and mumbled his thanks. Entering the lecture hall he became a man transformed. Here was his life. Here he expounded upon ancient history. Moving like a man rejuvenated, he crossed to the rostrum and smiled benignly upon the assembled undergraduates. They smiled respectfully at him, for even though they did at times make fun of his forgetfulness, yet they still had a genuine liking for the lecturer who was so willing to help them to the full extent of his power. Remembering his own struggles, he took pleasure in helping the student in difficulties, instead of flunking him as was so often the case with other professors. Glancing about him to see that his class was complete, and all were ready, he said, "We are going to continue with our discussion about one of the great enigmas of history. The Sumerian civilization." "It's a mighty civilization which seems to have appeared in a most mysterious manner and disappeared in an equally mysterious manner. We have tantalizing fragments, but no clear picture. We know, for example, that 3,500 years BC the Sumerians were preparing beautifully written manuscripts. We were fragments of them. It's fragments, and no more. We know also that the Sumerians had a musical system which differed from any other system of musical notation throughout the Old or New Worlds. There has been discovered a clay tablet which by scientific methods indicates an age of some 3,000 years. The tablet has engraved upon it musical symbols which lead us to suppose that it was a hymn, but it has defied musical interpretation." The old man paused. His eyes opened wide as if seeing something beyond the normal vision of man. For a minute he stood thus, gazing into the infinite, then, with a strangled groan, he dropped to the floor. Stunned amazement held the class motionless for a moment, then two students rushed to his side, while another hurried out in search of medical assistance. A hushed assembly stood respectfully aside as two stretcher bearers carefully lifted the unconscious man, placed him upon the opened stretcher, and bore him away to the waiting ambulance. Who had been called, appeared full of bustle and dismissed the class for the afternoon. Away in the cool hospital room the old professor, now regained consciousness, muttered to his doctor, "Strange. I had the distinct impression that I had lived through this incident before. that I knew the origin of the Sumerians had been working too hard. But I knew the answer, and now it has faded. Strange, strange. The aged man squirmed uncomfortably upon the hard wooden bench, crossing first one leg then the other. From time to time he lifted half-frightened eyes to gaze about him. From the end of the room came the harsh, impersonal voice of the nurse grating out her monotonous orders. "Garland, you are to see Dr. North. There are your cards. Take them in that door, and wait until the doctor speaks to you. You go to therapy. They want to do some test. Go down the corridor." The voice continued like the voice of a bored announcer quoting the fat stock prices. Shuddered at the rows and rows of people before him. Unaccompanied, new patients with relatives with them, and some with burly attendants waiting nearby. The hours dragged on. And there a man or woman screamed in the grip of some mental fantasy. Nearer, a man shouted, "I got her, and when you got her you got her." Jumping up, he rushed across the room, scattering people right and left, elbowing aside a clutching attendant, tripping a clerk, before diving headlong through an open window. Throughout the ensuing commotion the nurse's voice droned on imperturbably. The dull red brick buildings shimmered in the increasing heat. Glass of the many windows threw back the sun's reflection, and showed the thousands of bars across the windows. Scores of blank-eyed men stooped and shuffled as they grubbed along the gravel of the paths in search of weeds. Attendants loitered alertly in any available shade as they supervised the toiling men. Farther along, where the grassy slopes met the main drive, lines of dowdy women bent to the task of picking litter and stones from the grass before the mowers could do their work. Beneath a spreading tree a gaunt woman stood in the pose of utter majesty as she scornfully surveyed the two watchful women attendants who were poised in anxious expectancy. 30 at the main gates two attendants stopped cars entering that the occupants might be directed. An inmate, appearing casual, tried to slip out behind an attendant's back, but was soon stopped. "Ow, Alf," the attendant admonished. "Back in you go, none of your tricks, I'm busy." And the high stone walls and heavily barred gates pedestrians peered in curiously, getting a thrill out of a forbidden peep at life inside the walls. In admittance the middle-aged man stood up uncertainly as his name was eventually called. Rising to his feet he walked to the nurse at the desk and said, "It is all a mistake. I—"
"Yes, yes, I know. You are as sane as can be," interrupted the nurse. "They all say the same." Sighing, she picked up a card and some papers and signaled to a waiting attendant. "Had better take this one to Dr. Hollis," she said, when the attendant appeared. "He says it is all a mistake and he is sane. Mind he doesn't get away." "On, fella," said the attendant, grasping the middle-aged man by the arm and leading him through a small door. Together they trudged along a corridor lined with doors. Came sighs, from other screams, and from yet another a queer bubbling sound which made the attendant jump to an alarm and energetically summon assistance to one whose life was bubbling away through a cutthroat. "Seemed to shrink."
"Scared, eh?" "Our attendant."
"You ain't seen nothing yet."
"You will." At last they stopped before a door. The attendant knocked and a distant voice called, "Come in." Pushing the middle-aged man before him, he entered and placed the card and papers on the desk.
"The one for you, doctor," said the attendant as he turned and withdrew.
The doctor slowly reached out a languid hand and picked up the papers and compared them with the card. Paying the slightest attention to the middle-aged man, he settled back in his swivel chair and began to read. Until he had read every word, and made notes, did he look up and utter a terse, "Sit," said the doctor as his patient sat shakily before him.
"About?
How do I think you can be in two places at once? Tell me all about it."
He sat back with an air of bored resignation and lit a cigarette.
"Well, doctor," said the middle-aged man, "for some time I have had the strangest feeling that another part of me is living. In some other part of the world, I feel as if I were one of identical twins, sometimes almost completely in rapport with the other." The doctor grunted and knocked the ash off his cigarette. "Any brothers or sisters?"
"The report says none, but it could be wrong."
"No brothers, no sisters, and no one with whom I am sufficiently friendly to account for this feeling. It is exactly as if I sometimes get in touch with another me somewhere else, someone who also is aware of this feeling." He stubbed out his cigarette and said, "How frequently do you have these remarkable occurrences? Can you predict their onset?" The middle-aged man replied, "I may be doing something quite ordinary,
Then I will experience a tingling in the navel, and after that I feel as if I were two telephone lines which have been crossed and both parties are receiving their own telephone calls as well as those of the other. HMM, mused the doctor. Does it inconvenience you in any way?
It does, the middle-aged man replied. Sometimes I speak out loud and say the darndest things, he remarked. So I see from this report we'll have to commit you to an observation ward until we can get the matter straightened out. You seem to be living in two worlds at the same time. At the doctor's signal the attendant entered the room. Take him to observation B3 please.
I will see him later in the day, and motioned to the middle-aged man, and together they turned and went out of the doctor's office. Motionless for a moment, then pushed his glasses up to his forehead and energetically scratched the back of his neck. Lighting a fresh cigarette, he leaned back in his swivel chair and put his feet on the desk.
It seems we have a lot of people in nowadays, he said to himself, who believe they are living twin existences. I suppose next we shall have people saying they are living in parallel worlds or something.
The brr of his telephone jerked him back to the present, and slipping his feet off the desk he reached out for the phone and got ready for the next patient. 32. There are such things as parallel worlds because everything must have its counterpart in a reversed state, just the same as you cannot have a battery which is only positive or only negative. There must be positive and negative. That is a matter to be discussed in our next chapter. Now we have parallel worlds. Unfortunately, scientists who have been afraid of losing face or something, or sinking into matters beyond their depth, have confused the issue because they will not face up to the thought of having genuine research. Yet in India the adepts of years gone by referred to their Linga Sharira, which means the part of the body which is in a different dimension, beyond the three dimensions of this world, and so cannot be perceived normally by a person existing in this three-dimensional world. We have to remember that upon this world we are confined to three dimensions, for this is wholly a three-dimensional world, and to the average person who has not studied anything about metaphysics the fourth dimension is something to laugh about or to read about in some remarkable science fiction. Not merely is there a fourth dimension, but beyond the world of the fourth there are the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, the eighth, and the ninth. In the ninth, for example, one attains realization and is able to comprehend the nature of things. One is able to comprehend the origin of life, the origin of the soul, how things started and what part mankind plays in the evolution of the cosmos. Nth dimension, also, man, still a puppet of the overself, is able to converse face to face with his overself. One of the greatest difficulties is the unfortunate fact that scientists have set up all sorts of extraordinary and arbitrary rules, and if one dares to contradict anything that these scientists say, then one is really ostracized. An example of that may be found in the way in which the medical profession was completely crippled for hundreds of years because of the works of Aristotle. It was considered to be a great crime to do any investigation into the human body because Aristotle had taught all there was to know, ever. Until the medical profession could escape from the dead hand of Aristotle, they could do no dissections and no post-mortems, and they could do no research. And astronomers had much the same difficulty when 33. They taught that Earth was not the center of creation because some early wonderful man had taught that the sun revolved around the Earth, and that everything existed for the comfort of mankind. But now we have to get on with our dimensions. Here on this Earth we deal with that which is commonly known as three dimensions. See a thing and we feel a thing, and it appears solid and real to us. We had to deal with an extra dimension. The first thing would be, well, what is this extra dimension? We could not quite comprehend it. What could be a fourth dimension? Worse, what would be a fifth, and then go on up to the ninth, or even beyond the ninth? The best thing is to consider first an ordinary tape recorder, because most people have access to a tape recorder or have seen one. We have a tape recorder running at a very slow speed, less than an inch a second. At such a slow speed one could have a tape message last for an hour. We made the tape playback at, for example, a foot a second, then the speech would be quite unintelligible to us. The message upon the tape would not have altered in any way. The words would be the same,
but in effect we would have moved our speech to another dimension, and so we could not comprehend the speech. Before we could comprehend that which was upon the tape, we should have to play the tape at the same speed as that employed in recording it. Incidentally, marine biologists have used tape recordings and have discovered that fish of all kinds talk. There is, in fact, a special phonograph record giving sounds of the sea in which there are the sounds of the fish talking to each other, and even lobsters and crabs communicating. If you find this hard to believe, remember that dolphins have had their speech recorded on tape. Dolphins speak many, many times faster than humans, so the speech was recorded on tape and was quite unintelligible to humans, but the tape was slowed to a dimension, speed, acceptable to human ears. The scientists are trying to decipher the tapes, and at the time of writing this it has been stated that these scientists are able to compile a vocabulary so that eventually they may be able to communicate in extenso with dolphins. To our parallel worlds. Years ago, when I had escaped from the Russians and was making my slow and painful way across Europe to eventually reach a free country, I chanced to stop in war-torn Berlin, then being desecrated by the savage Russians. I was walking about wondering what to do next, wondering how to pass the time until nightfall, when I should hope to be able to get a lift upon my way towards the French border. Walked along looking at the still smoldering ruins where a light bombing had reduced most of Berlin to shattered rubble. In a little cleared spot beneath twisted steel girders now turning red with rust, I saw a ramshackle stage set up surrounded by those bomb-wrecked buildings. There was scenery of a sort upon the stage, scenery made from bits of material salvaged from the wreckage. They had some poles, and from the poles were stretched pieces of sacking so as to obscure as much as possible a view of the stage from those who had not paid to enter. I was interested, and looking farther I saw there were two old men. One was standing before a curtain taking money. He was tattered and unkempt, but there was a certain air of something, majesty, I suppose, about him. I forget now how much money I paid to enter, not much because none of us had much money in war-torn Berlin, but as I paid he put the money in his pocket and courteously motioned me through the tattered and bedraggled curtain. As I went beyond the curtain I saw some planks bridging rubble, and on those planks people were sitting. I took my seat, too. Then a hand came through the curtain and waved. Old man, thin, bent with the weight of years, shuffled to the center of the stage and made a little address in German telling us what we were going to see. Turning away he went behind the backdrop. For a moment we saw him with two sticks in his hand, and from those two sticks depended a number of puppets, inanimate lumps of wood, roughly carved to represent a human shape, dressed up in gaudy rags, with painted features and lumps of hair stuck on top. They were crude, they really were crude. And I thought that I had wasted money which I could ill afford. But, I was tired of walking, tired of just ambling about attempting to evade Russian and German police patrols, so I kept to my hard seat and thought that as I had wasted the money I would waste some time as well. And shuffled out of sight at the back of his little ramshackle had rigged up lighting of some kind. These were now dimmed, and on this very makeshift stage appeared figures. I stared hard and rubbed my eye. For these weren't puppets, these were living creatures. Gone completely was the crudity of hacked wood daubed over with color, topped with horsehair and swaddled with bits of rag salvaged from bombed ruins. People each with a mind of his own, people intent on the task at hand, people who moved of their own volition. There was no music, of course, and no sound that is except for the asthmatically wheezing of the old man now hidden in the back. Sound was not necessary. Sound of any kind would have been superfluous. The puppets were life. Every movement, every gesture was expressive. Speech was unnecessary, for these motions were in the universal language of picture, pantomime. There seemed to be an aura around these puppets. These puppets who had now become people, they seemed to take on the identity and the personality itself of that which they were at the moment representing. No matter how much I peered, I could not see the strings going from the heads. These were indeed artfully hidden against the background. For me, scenes of life were being enacted with absolute fidelity to the human counterparts. I lost myself in following the actions and the motives. We watched human drama and our pulses raced in sympathy with the underdog. This was excitement. This was real. But at last the show came to an end and I roused myself as if from a trance that a real genius was controlling those puppets, a master of masters. And then the old man came out from behind his stage and bowed. He was shaking with fatigue, his face was white with the strain and covered with the thin sheen of perspiration. He was indeed an artist, he was indeed a master, and we saw not a tattered, battered old man clad in rags, but the genius who manipulated those crude puppets and brought them to life. As I turned away I thought of the things I had learned in Tibet. I thought of my beloved guide the Lama Minya Dondup, and how he had shown me that man is just a puppet of his over-self.